Welcome to the Toasted Sister Podcast. I'm Andy Murphy. An article by the New Food Economy came out a few weeks ago about Tonka Bar, which is the bison bar meat snack that sometimes has cranberries and wild rice in it. It's from a native-owned company, and the meat bar is a traditional Lakota food item. And the article was about how the idea for this meat bar was appropriated by a non-native company called Epic. And Epic took credit for creating this bar and saw a huge boom in business. And that company was bought by General Mills for $100 million. You can imagine how Tonka Bar feels. And we'll hear from Mark Tilson about that. He's my guest today, and he's the president and co-founder of Tonka Bar and Native American Natural Foods.
From the Pine Ridge Reservation, decided to very deliberately launch the first buffalo-based meat snack nationally, and we created the Tonka Bar as the first reservation-based nationally distributed brand. And we launched it at Black Hills Powwow in October of 07 and went into national distribution in 2009.
I've had plenty of Tonka bars before. There's a couple of stores here that sold them here in Albuquerque, and they are pretty delicious. They are savory and sweet in all of the right places, and I'm really glad that you could be my guest today. So let's start, I guess, from the beginning. Can you tell me about the traditional origins of this Tonka bar?
Well, a Tonka bar is based on the traditional practice that the Lakota people call wasna, which is the art of using whatever high-acid fruit they had with their protein to preserve their meat. And so they made a very dense, nutritionally dense, high-protein snack called wasna. It wasn't really even a snack. It was, you know, a principal way that they were able to survive through winter and have food that matched their mobile lifestyle. I call it America's original packaged fast food, because it would, after it was created, often they would pack it in the fat of the animal that they were using, in this case, buffalo, and they would pack it back into the stomach of the buffalo and then heat fat to seal it so it could last for very, very, very long periods of time without going rancid. And they, and you know, a hunter or warrior or the community could carry that with them. And in developing the product, we learned, you know, that a lot of people know of the Cree word pemmican, which is also in their language means all mixed up, that tribes pretty much all over the world before refrigeration, this was the way that meat was preserved. That wasn't completely just dried out into jerkies. And we were approached in 07, I think, or it was 06, maybe Carlene Hunter and I, who are social entrepreneurs on the reservation, we were approached by a group of buffalo producers trying to find how to add value to their product. And after doing a lot of work and study and visiting with the community, we developed this product as a way of trying to break the economic and political isolation of the reservation and create an economic foothold so we could participate more in helping to build a healthy food system, but also help create a sustainable economic system that that benefited both the community, the employees, and the producer.
All right. And how did how was business in the beginning, and how did it fluctuate over time?
Well, when it first came out, you know, we held an honoring at the Black Hills Powwow, and we wanted to honor all the people who had helped bring the buffalo back from extinction who had come before us. So we gave away about 10,000 bars at that powwow and a lot of tattoos, and pretty much, you know, asked the community for support on launching this. And it was a lot of excitement and made a lot of local press. And that local press grew into the national press and then into the international press. And when the product was only 2 weeks old, it was on the cover of the taste section of the New York Times. And from there, it grew at a really rapid rate, often doubling the previous month's sales. Up until around August of 08, when the whole economy in the country locked up and buyers quit, you know, adding new product. And then when we brought the product back out in the fall of 2009, we had to restructure after that. We grew very, very well, went into national distribution, starting with co-ops and natural food stores. In 2010, it won Backpacker Magazine Best New Product of the Year, which is an innovation award that put it into all the REIs and many outdoor retailers and national parks across the country. And then it grew into sort of mainstream distribution, like through places like Natural Grocers by Vitamin Cottage and Whole Foods. And it continued to grow. And in 2015 and 16, it sort of looked like this brand was going to become big enough to hit our goal of really having a major positive impact on the reservation. And that's when all the international, multinational corporations recognized the value of the category and how fast it was growing. And so hundreds of millions of dollars of capital started flowing into the category. And we raised very little capital to keep up with the competition, mainly because people love the authenticity of the brand, the fact that it really is the only nationally certified. We're certified by the American Indian Agricultural Council as a Native American-made product in national distribution, and people really like that. But it's also what made people hesitant to want to invest in us, because how authentic the story really was and still is. It's kind of taken a little bit back and forth, if you know what I mean.
Mm, I think so. I mean, are you talking about, like, you think that people were a little bit turned off by just how authentic? Is that what you're saying? How authentic the product is?
What that means is it, as a Native American brand, and if you're a venture capitalist, so your goal is to come in and buy a brand and make multiples of your investment and exit. How do you come in and buy a Native American brand and make that exit and keep that brand authentic? Because, you know, like, our brand is partially owned by our employees. You know, it really is a Native American brand. It's not just having Native American imagery on the package. It's actually owned and based in the community, which is why the convention, adventure capital looks at that as, wow, that's great, that's what we're looking for. But then again, where is their position? Because they sort of have to break the authenticity. So that's why we're kind of restructuring right now, and we've launched a second company, which is a producer co-op called Tonka Resilient Agriculture, so that we can really secure the position of the Native American producer who's actually producing the product. Because our goal, of course, is to have the brand grow and to increase the impact in the community and onto the land and back to the buffalo through the people who are committed to living on the land and running their ranches in a regenerative, following a regenerative practice, whether it's grass-fed beef or wild-raised buffalo. It creates an added challenge to raise the capital. You also have, you know, the other challenges. You're coming from one of the poorest, most isolated places in the country. And then you have the overall isolation that all indigenous entrepreneurs have, which is, even the ones who are like us, who are highly, you know, we've won many, many awards and we've been highly successful, we're pretty much invisible to the investor groups in many, many ways. And that's not a problem unique to us. It's a problem that Native American entrepreneurs have across the country.
Hmm. And what do you mean by invisible?
We're not at the table when people are, like this issue we were talking about with General Mills buying one of our competitors for $100 million. I don't think that they strategically said, how could they hurt us? They just didn't pay any attention that we're the company that actually created innovation and built this category. And so, as in most cases, the native folks who are involved in it are just basically invisible.
I wanted to ask about the community. How is the community involved, and how is this company and the other companies that kind of branched off from Tonkabar a positive venture for the community there in Kyle and in South Dakota there?
Well, during the first year while we were trying to create the product and build the business plan, we also spent quite a bit of time in that first year visiting with the community, whether that was informally in meetings or public feeds or actual formal ceremonies, to ask both elders, youth, people on the government policy side, what do folks think about us creating a brand out of a sacred animal, out of an animal that's been sacred to the Lakota people, that the Lakota people consider it to be its sister nation? And, the instructions we got from the elders was, if you guys do right by the buffalo and right by the land and right by the people, then we will support you. But if you just become another exploiters, then we won't. And we were asked by the community, elders in the community, to not name it Wasnaw, to not turn Wasnaw into a commercial product. So we didn't. Working with a group of youth on the reservation led by the well-known native or Oglala graphic artist, Walt Poirier, Walt led us through a process which led to the name of Tonka, meaning taking something that's big or biggest or all-encompassing as the biggest, most grandiose idea we could come up with to change the situation on the reservation. And that's where the name Tonka came from. And then we took that back out into the community, into the elders, and it was very, very well supported. Since then, that has grown to creation of an employee group now that owns some percentage of the company and is actually involved much more in the actual ownership side, because one of our long-term goals is wealth creation on the reservation, not just we're trying to go beyond job creation. And in doing that, we've also expanded out now and created, we're in the process of launching a new producers co-op called Tonka Resilient Agriculture to try to help facilitate more people who want to get into buffalo ranching and help keep them at the table to bring them up in the value chain. So if you look at the value chain of, say, the cattle industry, since most of our Native American producers are cow-calf operators who have to refinance each year, they're actually at the bottom of the value chain. That's why the statistic that you read, depending on which reservation, that shows that anywhere between 35 and 65% of the agriculture output of most of the larger land-based tribes is going to non-native producers. And so trying to attack that and change that by moving them up the value chain is critically important to our long-term goal. And at the same time, working with people to follow a more regenerative practice that's also more resilient during the climate change that we're all experiencing, because everybody's learning how to grow food now in a climate that is much, much changed and will continue to change, which means the importance of a keystone species like buffalo that are essential to the health of the prairie are also essential to the health of the community as well. So, there's even the cultural revitalization part of it, where some of our producers are more into protecting and bringing back the traditional practices around how buffalo are cared for, communicated with, and yes, hunted as well, but also utilized. So, we're trying to be supportive of all of that as well. And we've also created a nonprofit, which is called the Tonka Fund, which is a South Dakota nonprofit. And the purpose of that is to provide both technical assistance and direct grants to Native American producers, since so many folks on the reservation have a huge number of barriers to access, whether they're trying to access their own land or leased land or purchased land, even just to get into the industry, because it is such a capital intensive process. And, you know, if you didn't grow up in a ranching family and you don't have access to even the basic ranching knowledge and resources, it's very hard to get into. So we're attempting to try to figure out, you know, where's the next generation of buffalo producers, or, you know, most of the native guys don't like to be called buffalo producers. I should say most of them call themselves caretakers or buffalo caretakers. Because they're not producing, they're really protecting. And so that's a really big part of, you know, when you think of America's grasslands, the land from central Canada to central Mexico that, you know, was the largest, you know, one of the largest savanna prairies in the world, which had the largest, you know, herds of roving animals, the buffalo on them. The buffalo actually built this incredible regenerative ecosystem, you know, that at one point had the ability to sequester more carbon than even the rainforest. And only about 3% of America's virgin unplowed prairie is left. And as far as we can figure, about half of that exists just within the 14 large land-based tribes. And so when you look at these deep root structures that are able to sustain drought and even help grow buffalo even during drought, that prairie grass that people drive by and say it looks like nothing, they're really essential for our grandchildren's survival, and protecting it is really, really essential. So that's part of, you know, what we view as our obligation to both the community, the tribal community, and the buffalo community, since they've always been as one, and we try to work together with them as one. When you think of the destruction of the buffalo, you know, it's really the first corporate takeover of a sustainable food system. You know, there were somewhere between 60 and 70 million buffalo in 1800, and there were 1,000 left in 1900. And now we're back up to about 500,000. And that was really done, you know, through entrepreneurship, both by tribes, tribal members, and private ranches. It's only been in recent years that conservation groups and the federal government have created conservation herds in national parks and all that. But that's a very small percentage of buffalo compared to what you're going to see in tribal herds and entrepreneurial herds.
Right. And then when you say like tribal herds and entrepreneur herds, are you talking about like the differences between like the pure buffalo and then the buffalo?
No, I'm talking about, you know, the Intertribal Bison Cooperative, which is a network. I think they have up to 60 members. Those are actual tribal governments who run herds, mm-hmm. as opposed to individual tribal members who are ranchers who run herds.
Got it.
You know, and we work with both, but it's important to distinguish the difference because of their access to land and resources are quite more substantial for the government-run herds than the individual family or rancher, Native American rancher who says, I want to get into this. It's a big challenge for them. I mean, there's a reason why the buffalo industry is driven by two billionaires, you know, Joe Ricketts and Ted Turner, because it is capital intensive. But, you know, I also believe that there's a social issue here, which is the buffalo were destroyed to subjugate Indians. Indian people have spent, you know, the better half of the last 100 years trying to bring them back. And there's a social issue in terms of a right. You know, there throughout all of oral history, at least, of the Great Plains tribes, they've been with the buffalo, and the buffalo have been part of them. And they consider themselves the sister nation. It's part of the Lakota people's creation story. So there's a right to these buffalo in both morally, but even in a social justice standpoint, in my opinion.
All right. And to go back to, you know, the business end of things here, you mentioned, you know, the company that General Mills bought and this company, Epic Bar. How does that make you feel seeing that, you know, this non-native company sort of just took off and, you know, kind of left you guys and, you know, everybody else in the dirt here?
Well, I mean, we're talking about power and money. So does it surprise me that organizations with power and money ignore truth and justice or ignore what, I mean, the exploitation of Native American food systems, like I said, goes back to as far as you want to go back in contact with European. I mean, when was Jack Weatherford's book, Indian Giver, came out, 25 years ago, where he documented everything from the potato to the tomato to corn to salmon to buffalo. You know, all of these core onions, core ingredients came from indigenous tribes in North America. And, you know, I would urge you to do this. Go to any major natural food show in America and look at the number of Native imagery on food products. If you think that there's a lot of cultural appropriation going on in the fashion industry, just visit any natural food store, natural food show, and you will see, you know, many big chief Indians and teepees and as much adaptation trying to present themselves as if they are have some kind of connection to the community as not. So how it made me feel, it made me feel a bit both mainly angry because of, you know, the groups we're working with, you know, our friends, people like Whole Foods. It turns out, you know, some of the investors and the original people were directly tied to some of the groups we were directly working with. So it makes you feel like at a time when folks verbally say they want to help fight poverty and verbally say they want to help protect the environment and support regenerative agriculture, their actions are actually the opposite of it. So rather than supporting the creation of food systems, they're actually investing not just little bits of money. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars against the creation of these food systems. And in their world, I mean, they're a $50 billion corporation. It might look like nothing, but in our world, you know, it's a very predatory attack. And it goes beyond just fighting for them for customers or shelf space. I mean, they use their power to try to buy out your supply chain, to buy out your technical advisors, to even buy your co-packing capacity. I mean, it's a deliberate effort to shut down Native business. At the same time, when rhetorically we're all saying from a policy standpoint, if we're going to end poverty and overcome climate change, we need to build regenerative businesses, but the practice isn't there. So, you know, our business is similar to many, many Native businesses in that we're severely underfunded. We're one of the top 20 businesses in the category, so we've fallen from number 2 in the category to, I think, 20 under a SPINS report. But we're still the least, you know, while we're independent, we're not owned by a bigger company. It also means we have the least access to promotional dollars and growth dollars, which we're both used to, but it's hard to hold your competitive position and build something that can be strong enough to fulfill the needs of the community. I mean, the sad part to me is Pine Ridge doesn't need another struggling business. They need thriving businesses so that we can create more opportunities because the reservation is full of young people looking for opportunity who want to live in their community but aren't able to find an economic path to do that.
What are some things that entrepreneurs could, especially Native entrepreneurs, could do to, you know, sort of keep in that competition and keep, you know, that rank of number 2, number 3, instead of, you know, what we're, you know, going all the way to the bottom after a couple of years?
Well, we're a long way from the bottom. I mean, there's many other brands behind us, but I think what Native entrepreneurs do often is, you know, you sort of become the grass and the concrete. You find a mini market, a micro market, whether you're an artist or a food manufacturer, you build a micro market around your product and you limit your growth to that. One of our things that we decided from day one is we were going to very deliberately launch a national brand from Kyle, South Dakota, in the middle of the Pine Ridge Reservation. You know, we looked at Ben and Jerry's launching from Vermont and Patagonia launching from Oregon. And we said, you know what? Why do you have to be in Boulder or LA or Austin to launch a national brand? You know, let's launch it. You know, we've got the internet right here. Let's do this. We had, you know, some experience doing national marketing using the internet. You got to remember back then, Facebook was brand new. I mean, I remember the day the staff came, the young people working for us came in and said, we need to put this product on Twitter. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I had never heard of it.
Yeah.
And they said, well, let us teach you. And they showed us. You know, we were probably one of the first brands on Twitter. So I think what happens to entrepreneurs is you scale back your dream to try to find your market in order to survive rather than, and many of them have been very, very successful, you know, many native artists. But it still is a struggle because the capital markets haven't seen that there is real value. You know, when you look at the larger land-based tribes who, because their larger land base are in more isolated areas, so the impact, the positive impact that gaming has had on their economy is reduced. So they are much more heavily on agriculture. When you undercapitalize your access, your ability to create value of your own land, then that value creation goes to those with capital. So you end up with, you know, cow-calf operators who end up on the bottom of the value chain. So I think native entrepreneurs are incredibly good at finding micro markets. It's trying to break out of that micro market to really have a major impact that where we've been stopped or stuck, I guess. I don't want to say we're stopped because we're as resilient as the buffalo and we're not going anywhere. And you know, we will solve this problem and we're working with great teams of people who are helping us. And, you know, we're in no way going away.
All right. What are some things that we might see from Tonka Bar or any of these organizations part of it in the future?
You're going to see some new products coming out this year that will have more grass-fed and organic beef raised by Native Americans in some of our products. You're going to see some upgraded branding and marketing. You're going to see a big growth in the number of Native, independent and Native American producers in the industry. And you're going to see a bigger product selection as we continue to grow. And hopefully see more opportunity for Native people to take leadership into the natural food industry. I think that'll be one of the impacts of, you know, what you're seeing.
If you like the intro and outro music of this podcast, or you just like good live music in general, I have got some news for you. C.W. Ione, the creator of these great pieces, is going on tour next month from January 25th to February 3rd. So if you're in Arizona or California, this is your chance to see this rockin' duo live on stage. So go check them out on social media. Look for C.W. Ione. That's C.W. Ione. If you're still looking for a gift for your loved ones, I still have some 2019 Native American food calendars available at ToastedSisterPodcast.com. Your purchase helps keep this podcast going. Toasted Sister is supported by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, and this show now plays on The River. That's RIVR, Rising Indigenous Voices Radio. It's a new online radio station at theriver.net. That's theriver.net. You should go check it out.